I think it's one of the most universal experiences as a young person is school anxiety, going back to school, transitioning to a different school.
I just remember going back to school my junior year in person after having 18 months of online schooling, and suddenly all these things that were once, you know, again, normal, just feels so like overwhelming.
Welcome to Hope Starts With Us, a podcast by NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. I'm Dan Gillison, the CEO of NAMI and your host. We started this podcast because we believe that hope starts with us. Hope starts with us talking about mental health. Hope starts with us making information accessible. Hope starts with us providing resources and practical advice. Hope starts with us sharing our stories. And hope starts with us breaking the stigma. If you or a loved one is struggling with a mental health condition and have been looking for hope, we made this podcast for you. Hope starts with all of us. Hope is a collective. We hope that each episode with each conversation brings you into that collective to know you are not alone. Today, I'm joined by one of NAMI's ambassadors, Willa Amai, and one of NAMI's next-gen youth advisors, Angel Zong. Willa and Angel, thank you so much for being with us today and lending your voice to this very important topic. Willa Amai is a Los Angeles-based singer-songwriter who is passionate about using her platform and lived experience to help others in their mental health journeys. She is officially a college student who will be attending Harvard this fall. Yes, congratulations, Willa. Angel Zong is an undergraduate student about to start her senior year at the University of the Pacific, majoring in psychology and English and minoring in writing and ethnic studies, passionate about decolonizing mental health, promoting awareness about the importance of culturally informed care and intersectional advocacy. So we have an incoming freshman and a starting senior with us today. So, Willa and Angel, thank you so much for both taking the time to be here. Could you each tell our listeners a little bit more about yourself and how you came to NAMI?
Yeah, I can jump in. I did a service learning fellowship with this nonprofit in Stockton my junior year that had a program called Healing Pilipinx, Uplifting Self and Others, which was kind of focused on promoting culturally informed care, intergenerational trauma awareness, and kind of grassroots mental health advocacy within the Stockton community, specifically for the Asian American Pacific Islander community. It was very close to home for me because a lot of my mental health experiences, my lived experiences, have been very much related to intergenerational trauma, navigating trauma as a family unit, as a collective, understanding how trauma isn't always a singular event-based experience, but something that can be historical, collective, rooted in systems of oppression. So I did that, and through that experience, I learned more about NAMI, and I thought, oh, wow, this is a wonderful opportunity to, I think, make this topic more visible, because I think a lot of times, specifically within the Asian American Pacific Islander community, the community I'm a part of, there's a lot of stigma, even just with mentioning mental health. There's this kind of glorification of stoicism, of keeping it in, of, you know, that's what strength is. It's maintaining a stone face in the kind of midst of suffering, which, you know, isn't obviously the most healthy way to go about things. So I really wanted to make this topic visible. I think also for Asian American women, there's a lot of pressure to be silent and submissive. And I want to challenge that and also, again, like make myself visible and use my lived experiences to speak for people who've gone through the same things I have with intergenerational trauma and navigating that. So that's kind of how I got here today. And so I'm really excited. I'm really honored to be a guest and talking with Willa, who's amazing. And I've just met her today, but I've already know she has amazing things to share. So that's kind of my brief little spiel.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you sharing intergenerational trauma, and there's also vicarious trauma. And thank you. We're looking forward to getting into the topic with you. And I'm glad you started us off as the senior in college. And now we'll go to the incoming freshman, Willa. What brought you to NAMI?
Yeah, so I mean, I've always been really passionate about mental health advocacy. I was diagnosed with a generalized anxiety disorder when I was 12, which is relatively early for like a formal diagnosis. And so when I started getting help and I started going to therapy, it was something that was very taboo. And I went to a very small elementary school where you know, everything was very tightly knit and everybody knew everybody's business. And so nobody else I felt like was going through what I was going through. This, of course, wasn't the case, but it certainly felt that way. I felt ostracized from a community that I had been so tightly integrated to. And so when I started pursuing music professionally, and especially when I signed to IMG Models Worldwide, it became really important for me once I started gaining a platform and gaining the resources to speak out about mental health. And I felt like NAMI was the perfect organization for me to pursue that. So I'm really excited to talk about this today and to be here. I've loved working with this organization for years now. So yeah, it's an honor to be here and to be here with Angel.
Well, I'm so glad you're both here. And thank you for lending your voice, as I've mentioned. And I hope that at both of your universities that you have carried with and will carry NAMI with you, because we know that there are just so many students that need your voice and need your support, and they need to know they're not alone. So let's begin our conversation with this, and you know, just thank you for being such great stewards and ambassadors for NAMI. So let's talk about going back to school. You know, it's been quite a year. In the beginning of the year, we had a bunch of high-profile young people tragically lose their lives to suicide. Then we had an international war with Ukraine. Then we had school shootings and acts of hate highly publicized throughout the country. We also had more variants of COVID-19 along the way. Add to that the pressure of social media and all of the normal pressures of just being a young person trying to fit in, trying to figure out who they are, trying to pass your classes, trying to, you know, matriculate through from junior to senior year, trying to decide what university to apply to, and then waiting on those acceptances. Where would you say students' heads are right now as they go to school? And how do you think adults in their lives can best support them?
I would say overwhelmed. I just remember going back to school my junior year in person after having 18 months of online schooling. And something that people didn't talk about when they mentioned, you know, this return to normalcy is this sudden, like, suddenly all these things that were once, you know, again, normal, just feels so like overwhelming. And I would walk into the cafeteria and just feel so tired from hearing everyone talk and have all these people around me after like being isolated for so long. And no one really named that. I think it was just, oh, there's so much pressure to just transition immediately and just go back as if things were the same. And obviously that hasn't been the outcome of what's been happening. So yeah, overwhelmed. I would also say there's a lot of pressure to be a high achiever right from the get-go coming off of this unprecedented global event. I just remember, again, my junior year, like the first thing that my friends and I would bond over after we saw each other in person is like, oh, how tired are you? Oh, like I haven't slept in like these many days. I'm surviving on coffee. Oh, that's so funny. Oh, that's something to aspire towards because you're working so hard. And I just think that, again, like no one's really naming that. They think that, you know, that's a good thing. Oh, well, you're putting so much work in. We're going back to this normal idea of, you know, productivity culture. You should just be working 24/7. And again, there's no room or space to breathe or to really mourn. Because I think, again, even right now, after COVID-19's like height, we're in a period of collective mourning. People aren't being given the space to really sit in that. So yeah, overwhelmed. That's how I'm feeling. I can speak for my friends as well when I say that. And I will say, like, the one thing that really changed my perspective from thinking that this was normal, oh, you know, I'm just exhausted all the time, like, that's how I should be as a college student, how that's so funny, was I had a lot of professors, like, personally reach out to me and say, like, how are you doing? How are you feeling? Do you need an extension? And actually, my junior year, it was the first time in my life, my academic career, that I asked for an extension. And I thought it was going to be, like, this permanent scar on my record. So I would say for school staff and parents and caregivers, like, that's really the best you can do. Just like listen, see, advocate for people before they feel like they're in the place to have to do that themselves, you know, and that feels like a really desperate point. So yeah, that's kind of my experience and also speaking for my peers a little bit with that.
I love that. Thank you so much, Angel. And I'll come back to you in a minute. I want to go to Willa now and ask you the same question, Willa. Where would you say students' heads are right now as they go to school?
Yeah, I think to Angel's point, I think students, young people in general right now, after so much time alone in their rooms with exclusively time to reflect and look internally. There's this sort of universal experience, I think, of young people right now of looking outward. And I think for me, my experience in the end of my high school year transitioning into college was heavily impacted by the adults around me, their outlook on coming out of COVID, on their outlook on my transition. I think they were extremely instrumental, particularly my parents, in giving me this sort of infrastructure emotionally to make that transition. I completely agree with Angel. It was incredibly overwhelming to come back to school. Kind of, I think, at least for me, I was sort of expecting to a certain degree that after all of this time at home, where I think a lot of adults, especially connected with like schools and universities, began talking more about mental health and the importance of like mental upkeep and all that. I think I sort of expected for there to be more conversations about that once we returned, and it didn't feel like that in a lot of ways. And so my parents, who were so supportive in me having creative outlets with my music, in me having free time, in high school, I also had to ask for my very first extension in my high school junior year, and I like felt like it was the absolute end of the world. And my parents, I remember telling them at dinner, and they, without missing a beat, said that they were really proud of me. And I think small moments like that from people that you trust and look up to and care about are so, so integral for, you know, maintaining your sanity and being able to have moments of joy and not becoming sort of engulfed in the work and the pressure. I think generally students' heads are about where their parents' heads are at, or their guardians or their caretakers or their teachers. And so I think there is a level of responsibility for the adults in teenagers and young people's lives to promote the mental health values that they want these young people to have.
Thank you for that. And Willa, I want to ask you another question, and I want to come back to both of you with a follow-up. This question is, you're a singer-songwriter, and it's about interacting with others and sharing your music with others. How did the last few years of isolation impact your ability to do that? And how did you navigate that mentally?
I think lockdown definitely impacted my songwriting, both in terms of the sort of routine of it and also what I was writing. And so before lockdown, and still now, one of the most joyous kind of experiences in terms of songwriting is writing songs about other people, about people that I see on the street and create stories about in my head, the people that I meet, people I have relationships with. That is so, so fun. Even if the song that you're writing is sad or angry, there is so much emotion that you can sort of channel through writing songs about other people. And it's really helpful for sort of mental health upkeep. But once the lockdown happened and I wasn't seeing really anyone else, songwriting became a lot scarier, because suddenly the only person that I could write music about was me. There reached a certain point where I had to be brave, and I had to learn to write honestly about myself without the sort of facade of writing about another person. Like Emily Dickinson talked about how her poems were not about her. It was like a supposed person. And that sort of idea of shifting from the supposed person that really is me, but I don't want to say it's me, to being honest about what I'm writing about myself. That transition was scary, and it took a lot of working on myself to get there. But I'm glad that I was forced to do it, because I think my writing is in a better place now. And when I go to write now, I think it does even more for my mental health than it did before.
That is incredible. And are you sure you're not a senior in college? your wisdom is way past your years. Now I want to ask you all the same question. You both shared that you asked for an extension and you were very nervous about doing it. It's very interesting that you both mentioned it. And it's our social norms that had you feeling really not good about asking. How, as you came through that and you had the support, and all of a sudden you came out of the other side of that extension and you felt good. What could you share in terms of a student asking and a student being okay with asking?
I think like with everything else, it always starts with talking about it. I had someone say to me, actually during this period of my life where I was really struggling, asking for that extension before I was kind of offered it, was, You are not what you produce. You are not what you create. Anything that you make is additional. It's supplementary. Like, if you never did anything else in your life ever again, like, you're still enough and you're still you. And I had to think about that for a while, because for a long time, and I think this is applicable to a lot of high achieving, ambitious young people, is I really conflated my academic achievement with my worth as a person. I thought they were the same thing. And so when I wasn't feeling like I was performing at that level that I had been maintaining for so long, I really felt like that was a personal failure, almost a moral failure. Because I thought that this academic achievement was almost virtuous. And once I was able to talk about this and really say it out loud, I really could hear it in my own voice and think, that's not okay. That's not something I should keep maintaining as a mindset. So I would say that's kind of where I would advise people to start. Always start with the talking, always start with the reflecting. And then you'll be able to see how it shapes your worldview and your relationships with other people to allow you to seek that help and to allow you to really reflect on your own internalized stigma and kind of mindset about where your self-worth is and what it comprises.
This is very good. And Willa, you were just acknowledging what Angel was saying, and you began acknowledging early on as she talked about the grades are what you do. They're not who you are. What would you like to build on what Angel was saying for our audience there?
Yeah, I would say sort of to Angel's point, talking about the idea of failure and the sort of like holiness that I think high achieving students place around performing well and getting A's and getting good grades. When I asked for this extension, it was from my English teacher, and I'm going to name drop her because she was incredible. And her name was Amanda Fouché. And it was for our Hamlet essay. It was, you know, senior year, and it's already so stressful. And we were reading Hamlet in December. And so I was waiting for my college decisions. And the essay was about Ophelia, who, if you've never read Hamlet, is this sort of tragic love interest for Hamlet, sort of, who kind of takes on her own story. And she has a really, really tragic ending in the play. And so we were writing an essay about her. And I found it particularly pertinent to what I was going through at the time. And so when I went to sit down to write the essay, for the first time in my entire life, I had nothing to say. Because sort of similar to what I was talking about earlier about how terrifying it is to write music about myself, it felt like anything I put down on the page was revealing just as much about me as it was about Ophelia, or, you know, my analytical take on the play. And so I was really, really struggling to write it. And I asked for the extension, and I was thinking about it constantly, and I felt like I had failed my teacher because I cared so much about what she thought about me and about my writing. And then I finished the essay, you know, and I turned it in on time in terms of the timeline for the extension. And I handed it in to her, and I was nervous. And so I started rambling about why I turned it in late, like what my struggles were while writing it. And I was talking about it because I was so anxious about giving this paper back to her, and I felt like I had failed her or something. And with all the sincerity in the world, she listened and she said, "Thank you for telling me. I'll take that into consideration." And I realized that she cared just as much, if not more, about why I asked for the extension than the fact that I asked for one at all. And so seeing that from her, I think, for me, really changed my outlook for the rest of the year, and it will for the rest of my life. And so, yeah, I think moments like that where adults that you trust put into practice and lay out in front of you physically, you know, the sort of values that you hope to see in them and that you want to work on in yourself, that is so important. And it's always those moments that sort of, I think, change us for the better.
You know, thank you, Willa. And you just said something I want to say to any teacher, any professor, any parent, any caregiver, aunt, uncle, grandparent listening. You are critically important in the young people's lives that are around you and that look up to you. What Willa and Angel just shared, and what Willa just shared about, you know what, while it was important about the actual paper, I realized she cared. And always remember this, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And what Willa just said is that she will remember that interaction with that teacher the rest of her life. So to our educators, you're much more than teachers, you're educators. And you have an incredible impact on the lives of the people that come before you in your classrooms and in your academic settings. So now let's move on. At the end of last year, the U.S. Surgeon General issued an advisory on a youth mental health crisis further exposed by COVID-19. Earlier this year, the CDC also released statistics saying more than 1 in 3 high school students experienced poor mental health during the pandemic. And even before COVID-19, suicide was already reported as the second leading cause of death among people aged 10 to 34. And the CDC reported that youth mental health was already declining. I think now more than ever, it's important that we start getting past the surface level to check on people to see how they're really doing. How can young people support their friends and their peers' mental health? Angel, we'll start with you. How can young people support their friends and their peers' mental health?
Yeah, so I just spent like a week studying the Irish poet William Butler Yeats. So I have some of his lines, you know, imprinted on my brain right now. And I want to share one that I think really applies to this kind of idea of collective empowerment and collective growth, which is, I have spread my dreams under your feet, tread softly because you tread on my dreams. And so I mentioned earlier that we're in this period of, you know, collective mourning, but that also allows us to be in this moment of collective recovery. And so I think a lot of times we think of growth and healing as these individualistic processes, but really right now we're at a critical time to be able to support each other and know that you're not alone. That's obviously kind of, I guess, a cliche, but it's really not, you know, kind of related. There's this quote that I forgot who said it, but it says, every man is an island. And that kind of speaks to the isolation we really experienced at unprecedented height during the COVID-19 like pandemic. But also to counter that, like, we've built ships for a reason. Like, we're an island, you know, each person's an island. We've all kind of experience this idea of we're navigating life alone, but no, like, we're still connected regardless of whether or not we feel like, you know, this is a lived experience that is, you know, narrow in scope. So really, like, I just kind of hold these philosophical truths in mind when I approach my friends, knowing that maybe there's this kind of instinct to be like, no, I'm okay. You know, when we ask someone, how are you doing? We always expect them to say, oh, I'm doing great, I'm doing fine. We never really expect them to say anything else. So approaching those interactions with, you know, they don't have to be okay. I'm here to also say I'm not okay, and that we can experience this moment of community together if we both are able to sit in that truth and sit in that collective mourning and collective recovery. So yeah, approaching interactions with those kind of ideas in mind, and also kind of on the other end, my friends have been really integral to me, again, like, naming what I'm going through. Naming everything is always the first step to recovering or challenging it. So when I name the fact that I'm experiencing, you know, depression or anxiety, I'm able to process it in a way that, you know, allows me to really, again, sit in it and identify points of kind of community, because other people are feeling the same things. And we have this collective language to be able to not only understand it, but to understand that we're not alone.
Thank you very much. And the collective recovery is incredible. And thank you for that. And like you said, every man may be an island, but there are ships and boats. And so I love that. And I want to come to you, Willa, with the same question. How can young people support their friends and their peers' mental health?
Yeah, I mean, I think, Angel, you were just talking about the sort of expectation of when you ask someone how they are. And I think expectation plays a really big role in both our ability to help other people and our capability in sharing. So, you know, I think it's incredibly important to ask and implore your friends about how they're doing without expectation, and to maintain that line of support, that line of communication, even if in any given moment they don't feel comfortable using it. Because to make that offer once and for them to decline, like, I think for me personally, a lot of the time, I think people, when they offer help, if you don't in the moment feel comfortable taking it, there's this feeling that that was a one-time offer and it no longer stands, it no longer holds. And that really adds to the feeling of isolation, just sort of mentally and emotionally. And so I think to make it clear to your friends that you're there for their help if and when they need it, and not once when you feel comfortable or when you have a moment of like, oh, I should go check in on them. You know what I mean? I've heard a lot of people tell me when encouraging me to tell my friends about mental health struggles of, you know, they're not a stranger. But I think it would be a lot easier if they were, because you would never see them again. And the things that they learn about you will never come back to you ever. And you can just sort of put it out into the world and forget about it. But when you're talking to your friends, they see you again tomorrow and you care about what they think of you. And so it takes courage to talk to them. And so as friends, when you open that line of communication, give them time to gain that courage and to gain that strength, and come in with no expectation. I think that would be my biggest piece of advice.
That's incredible. And, you know, it what you're saying is very telling from the standpoint of, you know, when we talk about our friends, whether they're in my demographic, my age group or young adults, it is talking to your friend that is many times the hardest thing, because you're going to see them again, Willa. You're going to see them that next day. So it's strengthening your vulnerability and making sure that these are friends that care about you and you care about them, and building that relationship so you can speak honestly and candidly and authentically with them. So, you know, thank you for sharing. Now, NAMI recently published a bunch of back to school resources on our website for college students, teens, kids, parents, and educators, which you can access at NAMI.org. With that said, Willa and Angel, I wanted to also ask you, do you have any advice for any of our listeners who might be dealing with anxiety about going back to school, for you, Angel, back to school, and Willa, for you, transitioning from home to school that is, you know, in another place in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, I have a few. I think my more concrete piece of advice is to find any way you can to express yourself, either creatively or physically. Like, you know, if you are more of an athlete than sort of a musician or a writer, like, even if it's something new, even if it's something you've never done before, even if it's something you're terrible at, like, as you transition into a new chapter of your life, for a lot of people in a new state with different resources and different people around you, even if you can't maintain, you know, whatever your outlet was at home, find something new, look for something new. Even the pursuit of something new is an outlet in its own right. So that's my more concrete piece of advice. And then the sort of more abstract, emotional rambling that I'm about to go on is that I think anxiety, especially about school, is a very unique type of anxiety, in that it, in my experience, puts a lot of kind of emphasis on isolation and being an individual separated from the group. Because I think a lot of school anxiety, at least for me, has been born of social anxiety and meeting new people and this sort of fear and stigma that's kind of put around making friends being difficult and finding, you know, it being difficult to find your community and to find your, you know, your people. And so I think what's so funny about it, though, is that almost everyone experiences it. I think it's one of the most universal experiences as a young person is school anxiety, going back to school, transitioning to a different school. And yet its singular job is to make you feel alone. And so it's so difficult, so, so difficult to put this in practice. And so, you know, I say this knowing that it's so much easier said than done, but I'll say it anyway, which is to remember to sort of go back to the like cliche, but not a cliche, Angel, you were talking about earlier, is that you're not alone. The very thing that makes you feel alone is what makes you part of an entire community of young people all across the globe who are going through similar and different experiences as you, but who feel the same way on the inside.
Angel, I want to come to you in terms of back to school. How do you think that listeners might be dealing with that anxiety? What advice would you have for anyone that's listening that may be anxious and feeling a bit of anxiety about going back to school?
Yeah, I want to start off with saying what you're feeling is a natural reaction. And I'll say that again, because I think it's really important. What you're feeling is a natural reaction, especially now that it feels like not only, you know, the social threat of fitting in, but it's also an existential threat of safety. And we go into these environments, again, feeling very much like an individual. Oh, I'm competing with all these other kids for, you know, placements into, you know, top programs or to have the curve set in my class. But know that like people appear differently than what they're feeling on the inside. And again, to echo Willa, like what they're feeling on the inside probably mirrors what you're feeling. So again, like isolation, but isolation in community. So know that firstly, like your reaction is natural. I think that our first kind of reaction to that reaction is to be thinking, oh, this is just me. I'm overthinking. I'm ruminating. I'm, you know, catastrophizing. But that's your body telling you, I want to survive. I want to feel good. I want to feel joy. And that's something that should be celebrated in the sense that take that as an opportunity to carve out spaces for happiness as a daily practice. I think as Willa was mentioning earlier, and I think it doesn't always have to be, you know, an outlet. It can just be a treat that you give to yourself, you know, listen to your favorite song on the way to class, take a walk, take a Zoom break if you're, you know, still in remote schooling, which I'm so sorry if that's the case. Do things that are little presents to yourself. Know that you're someone who you can give gifts to and who deserves that. Because again, like there's this instinct to fall very deep into productivity culture, to experience each day as kind of, oh, I need to roll the rock up the hill again, like Sisyphus, and repeat that when I wake up. And that can feel very demoralizing. But when you take the attention to say, like, what if I like put the rock aside for a minute? What if I just sip my tea and I breathe in the fresh air, and that's something I deserve because I'm a person, regardless of what I do after this or before this? I think that can be really powerful, and it doesn't have to be something large.
Thank you so much, Angel. And thank you so much, Willa. And I want to come back to this right here. And Angel, at the very beginning, you talked about intergenerational trauma. And you spoke to that as something that is your life's experience and something that you're addressing. Could you tell us more about that?
Yeah, of course. I think in the context of schooling, it has a lot to do with my experience as a second generation immigrant and my mother as a single mother who was an immigrant as well. There's a lot of pressure to fall into this mindset of, again, you know, the only way to success, to happiness, is to work yourself to the bone, to suffer in the pursuit of a very concrete idea of success that may not align with your own desires for happiness or what your own pictures of success look like. So I think first, I think that's kind of contextualizing with it within schooling, that being an immigrant, being a first generation immigrant, like my mom, there's this mentality of, you know, you just have to survive. Thriving is a privilege. If you can make it to the next day, if you can get your kids in school, like that's what's going to matter. And I think that ties a lot of your self-worth again to what you can do for others, what you can do as a tangible, measurable outcome, what you can invest in rather than yourself. And that's a mindset that's hereditary. So I fell into that, I think, very early on in my schooling. I was a very high achieving person. If I got under like a 90 on anything, it felt like, again, like a personal failure. And I felt a lot of, like, I punished myself a lot mentally for that. And it came from, you know, my mother's perfectly reasonable mentality of, I just have to survive in this new environment where I'm isolated from my family, isolated from my support system, where I just, if I wake up the next day, like, that's enough for me. So that's kind of intergenerational trauma, I think, from my experience. And that is also, you know, of course, an intersectional experience with being, again, like an Asian woman, in which there's a lot of care work that's expected of you in addition to working full time and not being able to advocate for yourself in any way, and inheriting this idea of silence is your role. So yeah, like I think that definitely played a lot into how I approached schooling, how I didn't advocate much for myself until my junior year when I was desperate, you know, for an extension, and people had to see that in me first before I could feel like I could speak up, and feeling again like everything that I produced was what made me worthy of being in a room like this, of being able to speak about myself. And now I feel like I can speak about myself because I'm myself, and I claim that with full power and passion.
Thank you for sharing that. You've helped so many others just by this lens into what your experience has been, and appreciate you sharing that with our audience. And I have one last question to ask both of you. The world can be a difficult place, and sometimes it can be hard to hold on to hope. In fact, according to data released by the CDC earlier this year, nearly half of students felt persistently sad or hopeless during the pandemic. That's why each episode we dedicate the last couple of minutes of our podcast to a special section called Hold On to Hope. Willa, Angel, can you tell us what helps you hold on to hope?
I feel incredibly privileged because I have a lot of support around me that helps me hold on to hope. For example, my younger sister, Harper, she's 2 years younger than me, but she has been the most consistent support. I mean, she has loved me and supported me unconditionally for our entire lives. She looks up to me, and it seems scary sometimes when you feel that you're not okay to be put in a position of guidance for somebody else. But I think what it really did for me was remind me that I am worth so much more than what I gave myself credit for, and that I'm worth that position of guidance for her, that I am enough and that my guidance is worth something to her. And so I think having her, having my parents who support me, having friends who support me, and then being able to write music, having a pursuit that is both individual and communal. You know, in writing alone in my room, I have time to reflect by myself. And I'm reminded of the hope that I have in my daily life as I reflect and as I think about what I want to write about. And then on the other side of that coin, it's communal when I go to share that music. And I don't have to share all of it. And that puts me in a position of power as well. And that makes me hopeful as well. And so I think having both those individual aspects and those sort of community aspects of connection with yourself, with the people around you, those are the things that give me hope.
You know, Harper is very lucky. She's got a wonderful big sister. So thank you for sharing. Appreciate that. And Angel, what gives you hope and what would you like to provide as advice to our listeners?
Yeah, so Willa invoked Emily Dickinson earlier, so I kind of want to close with her because this is kind of a room of English lit fans and folks. So there's this really famous quote and from an Emily Dickinson poem that says, "Hope is a thing with feathers that perches in the soul." And she does something really powerful there. It's really simple, but she makes hope its own being with its own agency. And I think maybe this is my interpretation, again, as an English fan, but what she's doing there is making it very obvious that hope will persist whether or not we believe in it at that moment. It's something that perches in our soul. It's going to be there if we have to take a break from it and come back to it. And it's there for us. It perches in our souls. So I think that there's a lot of, you know, pressure nowadays with this new toxic positivity mindset to maybe feel hopeful 24/7. And that can become, again, demoralizing to feel obligated to feel that way rather than something that is a happiness that you can carve out yourself. So I just want people to know that you don't have to feel hopeful 24/7. Like, we are in a, you know, really disillusioning situation at this point, a very pivotal moment in history. And you can take a break from it and come back and it will always be there, because I think that the human condition is to actually defer to hope in the end. And so I just think that it's something that does perch in the soul, and it's something that you can maybe step away from if you need the moment to grieve, but it'll always be there. So yeah, just hope will always be there for you.
Wow, this is fantastic. We opened with Emily Dickinson. We're closing with Emily Dickinson. This is wonderful. I want to thank you both of you for coming on today and sharing your stories and experiences. This gives me hope in terms of speaking with both of you. And I think the future is in wonderful hands. This has been Hope Starts With Us, a podcast by NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. If you are looking for mental health resources, you're not alone. Visit NAMI.org/help to get in contact with the NAMI helpline and find local resources. Or if you are experiencing an immediate suicide, substance use, or mental health crisis, please call or text 988 to speak with a trained support specialist. I'm Dan Gillison, CEO of NAMI. Be well, and thank you for being with us.